Hey, you're listening to the Canadian Taxpayers Podcast, where we're all about lower taxes, less waste, more accountable government. I'm Franco Terrazano, your federal director here in Ottawa, and we've got a doozy of a guest on our show today. Okay, we've got Christine Van Gyn, the litigation director of the Canadian Constitution Foundation, and she's a former CTFer. She was my colleague, and as she was the Ontario director when I was the Alberta director at the time. So, Christine, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, always great to be reunited with you, Franco.
And folks, we're going to be talking about Trudeau's online harms bill. I've been getting so many questions about this, so I thought, hey, who better to ask than our friend Christine at the Canadian Constitution Foundation. So Christine, let's just start this way. Can you give us like an overview of what the online harms bill is and why you guys are sounding the alarm?
So the bill does a whole lot of different things. And to be frank, they do a lot of things that are unrelated to one another. And it sort of makes you wonder why they connected all of these things. So first, the bill proposes the creation of a new regulator called the Digital Safety Commission that would have increased penalties for certain types of harmful content that are posted on social media platforms. It would also increase the reporting requirements for internet providers related to what's called child sexual abuse imagery or child pornography, as well as the non-consensual disclosure of intimate images. This is also referred to by people as revenge porn. So there's that segment of harm. The other segment of harm that the Digital Safety Commission is going to be interested in relates to incitement of terrorism, incitement of bullying of a child, and it also addresses hate speech. And then, so there's that whole section of the bill that deals with this new online regulator for social media platforms. It doesn't apply to individuals. Then there's another section of the bill that is amendments to the criminal code. And those amendments to the criminal code deal with hate speech in particular. It increases the penalties for hate speech. It creates a new standalone offense for hate speech. An offense motivated by hatred. And this can apply to, you know, any existing federal offense. And it has an extremely high penalties. So if you commit mischief, but your mischief, which is an existing federal offense, but your mischief is motivated by hatred, instead of the low threshold for mischief, the low penalties for mischief, you're now subject to potentially to the higher penalties, up to life imprisonment. And then the third thing that this piece of legislation does is it makes amendments to the Canadian Human Rights Act. It reintroduces a civil remedy for hate speech, and hate speech at the Canadian Human Rights Commission will be charged with applying these changes to the act. It's on a civil standard, not on a criminal law standard. So it's on a lower standard. And what this piece of changed legislation will do is it will permit members of the public to file complaints with the Canadian Human Rights Commission for what they consider hateful speech. The Canadian Human Rights Commission can investigate those complaints. And if they think that the threshold is met, they can proceed to bring charges, or not charges, but a finding of liability at the tribunal, at the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, which is its own little, you know, separate government tribunal set up to deal with these specific issues. And they'll investigate whether the complained about content meets the threshold. And if it does, they can order penalties of up to $50,000 ordered to the government and up to $20,000 to the complaining person. And there's a whole lot of different things that this bill does. Obviously, no one here objects to stricter reporting requirements for child sexual abuse. And I think it was a mistake of the government to tie all of these sort of unrelated harms together, especially when there's constitutional vulnerability to a lot of provisions of this. I think if the government was actually serious about addressing child sexual abuse, they wouldn't tie those crimes and these reporting requirements to a constitutionally vulnerable bill.
So when I hear from a lot of our supporters and just Canadians writ large, you know, I hear a lot of concerns that this will limit people's freedom of expression, that this will limit people's ability to hold government accountable. And people are also just worried about what seems like a rise in government trying to censor people online. Can you speak to some of those concerns that are in this bill and just the broader context?
Yeah, so I think that it's the hate speech provisions that are the most likely to result in censorship, because hate speech is an unavoidably subjective term. It's sort of amorphous. A lot of it is in the eye of the beholder. So the different ways that censorship, I mean, all three types of these changes, the Digital Safety Commission, the Criminal Code, and the Canada Human Rights Act amendments, all three of them have the potential to result in censorship in different ways. So I think that online platforms may be more likely to take content down preemptively because concerns that they might have that some individual content is meets the hate speech threshold, especially because failing to comply with the law for these platforms comes with huge penalties and millions of dollars or a percentage of global revenue. So they're financially risk averse, and they're going to be more likely to take down content that might not necessarily reach the threshold just as a matter of precaution. On the other hand, a lot of these platforms already do have content community standards. So some of this content might already be removed as a result of the existing standards on those platforms. But I think it will sort of have to wait to see how this gets implemented. But certainly, I think it creates a penalty on the platform from the government for failing to take down content, whereas up until now, it was up to the platform if they wanted to remove content for violating their own community standards. Now, the criminal code provisions, I think, have the potential to violate, our constitution, right to freedom of expression. I also think that the penalties are really extreme. They're really high penalties. And what's important to know about hate speech is that the definition of hate speech comes from the case law. It comes from a Supreme Court case called Wetcott. And in that case, it defines hate speech as speech that is likely to foment extreme vilification or detestation. Now, in itself, this definition is sort of using just synonyms for hatred, in my opinion. So the definition remains somewhat subjective. And I think one of the things that the Wetcott case did was, because of the ambiguity in that definition, it expanded on what hate speech might be by giving examples of what the court called hallmarks of hatred. And it included things like calling a group pure evil. Now, I just as a thought experiment, you could think about how this might apply. I actually don't think calling a group pure evil will always be hateful. I don't think it necessarily will reach that threshold of hatred. And I gave an example of a church based in the United States called the Westboro Baptist Church. Now, I don't know if you are familiar with this church. This church is described by many people itself as a hate group. This is one of these churches. Before anyone comes at me for, criticizing a church, this church pickets the funerals of military veterans killed in service with signs using extremely offensive language. It uses hateful words to describe gay people, minority groups, minority religious groups. So this group in itself is a hate group, but it still is a religious group. So it's still calling this religious group pure evil. Would that meet the definition of hate speech? It certainly has a hallmark of hatred. Now, I don't think anyone should be sent to jail for calling the Westboro Baptist Church pure evil. I don't think anyone should be sent to jail for calling another extreme religious group like ISIS, who throws gay people off the roofs of buildings, pure evil, or comparing ISIS to comparing them to animals. That's another hallmark of hatred, is comparing a group to animals. Some of the hallmarks of hatred, yes, they do. They are quite self-evident. And of course, we know what hatred is. But when you attach these really high sanctions using an amorphous and subjective standard, and the standard and the penalties can be up to life imprisonment. I think that you are creating a problem. Now, the third way that speech can result in censorship is through these amendments to the Canada Human Rights Act. And as I explained in my last answer, this is through the reintroduction of Section 13 of the Canada Human Rights Act, which allows for a civil remedy. So a member of the public who sees, you know, you lost your temper on X or on TikTok or something, they complain to the commission, which is this little group of bureaucrats, and then they start investigating you. And they decide if the threshold for hatred on a civil standard, not a criminal standard, has been met, and they hold their own little trial. And they can, if they decide that you have engaged in hatred, they can fine you up to $50,000 and order $20,000 in damages to the victim, the person who complained. But some important things to know about how these tribunals work is that the complainant bears no cost to complain, but the person who has had a complaint made against them will need to retain a lawyer to help them with the investigation. And they will, if things proceed to the tribunal level, they'll obviously still need a lawyer, and then they can have costs ordered against them. The only option for costs ordered against a person who has complained is if things do proceed to the tribunal level, and a lot of these won't, because a lot of them will be frivolous and dismissed. But if it does proceed to the tribunal level, then and there's been an abusive process, then the tribunal can order costs against the complainant. But because the frivolous complaints are weeded out, that's unlikely to happen. And the other thing to know is abusive process is an extremely high legal threshold that almost makes this ability to order costs almost useless. So the government has said that it's this ability to order costs that has improved Section 13 of the Canada Human Rights Act that makes this version so much better than the version that was repealed a decade ago. And it was repealed because it was abused in the exact ways that I just described. The people filed frivolous complaints about people for mainstream or mainstream adjacent views who had published those views in mainstream columns. And another thing that's really important to know is that this is a bureaucracy that is seized with and obsessed with equity outcomes in society. So I think you can probably have a guess about what the types of people and their views are who work at these commissions, and the Overton window about what is considered acceptable speech has really shifted. So those complaints against mainstream publications that were dismissed back in 2008, when this law was in place, I wonder if those complaints would actually proceed to a tribunal today and may have an order against them, given that it's going to be staffed now with extra woke bureaucrats who are working within a system seized with and obsessed with equity outcomes. So I know it's a really long question, but this answer to your question, but this law really does a lot. And yeah, it's important to talk about all the different implications it could have for our right to freedom of expression.
No, we appreciate it. Hey, that's why we have you on the show. Rather than just me spouting something off, we want to know the details, because people are very concerned. And from what you said, especially some of these high penalties, some of the high costs that can just be associated with the process, I can certainly understand how this seems like it could totally chill freedom of expression, totally chill the public's ambition to hold government accountable.
Franco, one of the things that's important to know from a taxpayer perspective is, who do you think pays for these lawyers at this bureaucracy, at this new bureaucracy that's going to be paying staff to investigate all these frivolous complaints? And look, it's you, it's the taxpayer. You're going to be paying for these investigations into speech to make sure that no one tweeted a naughty tweet that needs to proceed to the tribunal. And this is a commission. The Canadian Human Rights Commission actually deals with important issues. It deals with discrimination against the public by Crown government agencies. And they're already overburdened. They already don't have the ability to address all the cases that they have now. Now they're going to be dealing with complaints from members of the public who want to, you know, file a grievance against someone they don't like so that maybe they will have a windfall of cash at zero cost to themselves. And you are going to be the ones paying for all of this.
Great point. I mean, the Trudeau government has already hired 98,000 extra bureaucrats. Folks, any guesses on how many additional bureaucrats are going to be having to fill this office, essentially? So hey, help us break through the noise. And you already kind of have, but let's really cut through it, because essentially what we're hearing from the government is that this is only, you know, just to protect children. This is only to protect legitimate threats of violence. But then obviously, as you have explained, there's huge freedom of expression issues here. So help us cut through what the government is saying. And if that were the government's legitimate goals of this, what should they be doing instead of this sledgehammer of a bill?
Look, I am here all day for higher penalties for people who commit sexual offenses against children. That is something I think every single person supports. In fact, I think that this current government is not a government that has a reputation for being hard on sex offenders or sex offenders against children. If they suddenly have a change of tune after putting Paul Bernardo and Luca Magnotta into medium security prison and suddenly have a change of tune on bail reform and on weapons offenses, and suddenly they're going to be tough on crime, I'm here for it. But I don't think they are. I think what they're doing is they're tying their more censorious proposals that are really politically motivated, to protecting children so that it inoculates them against criticism. It makes people like me, who will do anything to prevent sexual abuse against children, from being able to criticize this bill. I mean, it's very transparent. Most of us see through it immediately that these different aspects of the legislation should have been split off from one another, especially when some of them are so constitutionally vulnerable. I mean, former Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin has said that she thinks it's a 100% guarantee that this law in its current form is going to be challenged. So if this government really actually cared about being tough on child sexual abusers, they wouldn't have tied all these issues together.
So
it's a political choice.
Yeah, no. I'm so glad you laid it out that way. I think that it becomes very clear. And so, folks, you know, what I'm hearing from this legislation is like a huge impact on freedom of expression, a huge impact on even holding the government accountable, and just all of the online censorship that the government continues to ramp up, or at least bring these different bills into parliament and pass on some cases. So that's a huge issue. Of course, there's a huge taxpayer issue, the dollars and cents of having to hire these extra bureaucrats to do all of that censoring. But, you know, Christine, I know you're taking a lot of lead on this issue, and I know you guys are doing a lot of great work at the Canadian Constitution Foundation. What can average Canadians do to push back against this online harm censorship bill?
So this bill is just proposed legislation now. It still needs to go to committee. It still needs to go through Parliament and the Senate. So what we have done is we've created a platform so that Canadians who are concerned about this bill can email their own member of Parliament to ask for changes to this legislation. And as I said, we're not asking for changes to the increased reporting related to child sexual abuse. We're asking for changes related to the censorship elements of this bill and the hate speech elements of this bill that are going to result in state censorship. So you can visit the ccf.ca/fix-c-63. I'm sure Franco can put this in the show notes for this episode. And you just select your member of parliament, and we have a list of problems that we have with this bill that you can modify it yourself and send a letter to your member of parliament and ask for these changes to be made. We still have a lot of time before a next election. I think that there's enough time that this bill still will pass, but some of the more problematic elements of it, perhaps we could have removed.
Yeah, let's put some pressure on the government. Hey, let's go, folks. Christine, you know, I asked you to come on here to talk about the online harms bill, but now that I have you, I've got to ask you about the Emergencies Act, because you guys took the lead on that. So why don't you just kind of, you know, quickly, I guess, explain the issues with the Emergencies Act, what your team did to fight it and why, and where we are in the process now.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about this Emergencies Act case all day because it's one of the highlights of my career. So when Justin Trudeau invoked the Emergencies Act, we were one of the groups that challenged that invocation. We had public interest standing, and we fought the invocation in a judicial review at federal court. And of course, as I'm sure everybody knows by now, we won. The court found that Justin Trudeau's invocation of the Emergencies Act was unreasonable, that the regulations enacted under it, which allowed for the freezing of bank accounts and the prohibition on gatherings, that those regulations were unconstitutional. The court found that there was no threat to the security of Canada under the definition in the act. The court found that there was no national emergency. The court held that the gathering restrictions were a violation of the right to freedom of speech, and that the search and freezing of bank accounts was a violation of the right to be free from an unreasonable search and seizure. They also found that the government had argued that the decision was entitled to this special high level of deference because it had been made by cabinet, and the court found that no, they didn't. The cabinet was only entitled to the amount of deference laid out in the statute, not some special invisible high standard that they had claimed to have. So this was a victory on almost every important issue that we had argued. The one thing where we were not successful was the court found that there was no violation of the right to freedom of assembly. We have cross appealed. We just filed our cross appeal materials. The government is appealing this decision, obviously, because it was a really massive loss. I mean, they lost on almost everything that mattered.
You love to see it.
I could see that all day. So they appealed. We've cross appealed. We've argued that the right to freedom of assembly was engaged. And I think that this is probably going to be heard within the year. We don't know if it will even get to the Supreme Court based on current timelines, and if there's a change of government, depending on the outcome. But yeah, man, what a victory. What a resounding repudiation of the Trudeau government's position. And we're thrilled. And the court even gave a special shout out to the Canadian Constitution Foundation, saying that the case, that his opinion changed as a result of our advocacy and the arguments that we laid out, and that the case would not have gone forward without public interest advocates like us.
Well, congratulations and thanks for taking that issue on. And I guess I'm just wondering, so now they're appealing it, is it going to go to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, so that's what I said. So the timeline, what I think is, it's going to be heard within the year. We have I think towards the end of the year, and we don't know when the decision will come, maybe early January 2025, maybe. And we know there's going to be an election in 2025. So I think if there's a change of government, if the Trudeau government wins again and they lose the Federal Court of Appeal, they would appeal this to the Supreme Court. If there's a conservative government, if there's a change in government, and the conservative government would appeal, I don't know. I haven't asked anyone in the opposition leader's office, but I do think that if the decision that the invocation was unreasonable, if that's upheld on appeal, I don't think the conservatives will appeal to the Supreme Court. I haven't asked them, but that's my gut feeling.
Christine, anything else you want to plug away?
Just anyone who's interested in the work that we do at the CCF, you can visit the ccf.ca. That's where you can find that form to write to your member of parliament. And we also have a podcast called Not Reserving Judgment, where you can hear from me and my colleagues. We give bad legal takes. So we analyze what the worst legal opinion of the week was and kind of make fun of it. And then, of course, I have my own YouTube channel at the CCF on YouTube. So just search that up and you can see more of my friendly face giving you a breakdown on legal issues.
Christine Van Gijn, Litigation Director for the Canadian Constitution Foundation. Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much, Franco.